Welcome to this episode of Just the Disc. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. And who better to talk to about Blu-rays than my good friend Rob Galuzzo. Hello, Rob.
Hello, Brian.
It's always good to chat with you on our monthly new arrivals little show.
It is my favorite time of the month, quite frankly.
Aww. Very nice. Very nice. I'm a huge fan of this, and I am always curious. I see, you know, I watch your social media and sometimes your letterbox, although sometimes I don't, right around the time that we're recording, I don't look at your letterbox because I want to kind of be surprised. So I'm always curious.
Oh, I got doozies for you, pal. Don't worry. I'm going to surprise you. There's no doubt in my mind.
I am excited. Let's get into it, man. I'm sure we got some good stuff here. What's on the top of your stack?
All right, top of my stack. I'm staying on brand. I got a 3D title here for you, okay?
Right out of the gate.
I had to order this from Amazon Spain yet again. It seems that all of the Sony discs are no longer made in 3D, both here or in the UK. However, Spain, no problem. And what's funny about these discs is that they seem like they're made for the American audience. Like, even though it's got Spanish packaging, but when you put the disc in, it defaults to English. It's got English menus. That seems to be the deal. I am talking about Spider-Man Un Nuevo Universo.
Nice.
Which is how it's titled here. That means Spider-Man: A New Universe. And by the way, according to my fiance, this came out in France as Spider-Man: The Next Generation. but here in America, I'm talking, of course, about Spider-Man: Into the Spider-Verse.
My name is Miles Morales, and I'm Spider-Man.
Miles, gotta go!
In a minute!
Gotta go! In a minute!
But in my world, more than one wears the mask.
You're like me.
You can teach me to be Spider-Man.
This was never your city. It's mine.
We're gonna need backup.
Hey, guys.
Konnichiwa.
Hey, fellas.
Peter Parker.
This could not get any weirder.
Into the Spider-Verse.
And it's a no on the cape.
I think it's cool.
Spider-Man doesn't wear a cape.
Only in theaters December 14th.
Nice, nice. How's it look? I'm very curious about this.
I gotta tell you, man, it looks terrific. I did not see it in 3D in theaters. Again, I tend to try to avoid that when I can because it's always going to look much, much better on a home 3D setup. This one actually exceeded my expectations. I was kind of nervous because I heard through the theatrical presentation that there's a little bit of weird ghosting because there are some, basically this, if you haven't seen it yet, the style of this film is very comic booky. And so there's even portions where you could see like the dots, like the ink dots that you would in a comic page, the way it's printed. So I was a little nervous about that, but man, does it look fantastic. And not only that, it's one of the best Spider-Man movies that they've ever made. I know people are suffering from either superhero fatigue or, you know, that we've gotten a lot of Spider-Man movies at this point. This is like a great celebration of them all. It takes place in a slightly alternate universe. It focuses on Miles Morales, who is the Black Spider-Man. He's the Spider-Man of the Ultimate Spider-Man comic books. And I believe he's, I haven't kept up, but I believe he's made it over to the regular Marvel Universe as Spider-Man as well. And basically, we're following his story where the Kingpin, played by Liev Schreiber, or voiced by Liev Schreiber.
Oh, wow. I didn't even realize that.
The cast is fantastic. Basically, he's trying to open a portal into another dimension for actual noble reasons. I won't give it away, so you should see the movie. But he's actually doing something very emotional, which is on brand for Kingpin. But in doing so, they accidentally kind of suck Spider-Man's from other universes into this one. And so you don't just get Miles Morales or Peter Parker. You get Spider-Man Noir as voiced by Nicolas Cage.
Oh, so
you
good.
You get Spider-Girl, which is the Gwen Stacy version. There's the anime one, which I think was created by Gerard Way, the My Chemical Romance. And of course, my personal favorite, Spider-Ham. Because growing up, there used to be a comic book called Peter Porker, The Spectacular Spider-Ham. They literally throw everything in there. It's got great drama. It's a great story. It's really funny. It's one of the best Spider-Man movies out there. And more than anything, it hammers home the idea that anybody can be underneath that mask, which has always been the appeal of Spider-Man. So, yeah, just terrific. I know there's a 4K release of this, but I really, really, really recommend if you still have a 3D setup, definitely just go to Amazon. You could scroll to the bottom of Amazon.com, and there's a little icon or button that can switch you to other countries. And if you know, you're using whatever, Google or whatever, you'll have a translate option. Just go to Amazon Spain, order this, order Venom, and they will deliver it right to you. And they're not badly priced, to be honest. So this was definitely worthwhile. If you want me to dip in quickly into the special features, there's a ton of stuff on here. Most of them are pretty short. It's like several featurettes that are about 5-10 minutes long each. Hold on, let me bring it up really quick because I know it took a screen grab. Oh, there's a short film of there's a Spider-Ham short film that kind Excellent. Of acts as like a little prequel. It shows how he got to this universe. And then there's just tons of stuff. There's We Are Spider-Man, kind of about the evolution of the project, Spider-Verse: A New Dimension. Again, kind of talking about how they developed this version of it. And, you know, the cast, like getting to talk to all the voice actors. It's really fun to see them all in there, especially Nicolas Cage. Who I think at one point, like, he's waiting for direction, and he's like, "Oh, you want me just to go to full Cage? All right, I'll give you full Cage."
I'm glad he acknowledges there is.
Oh, he knows what full Cage is. So. Nice. So that's on there, and it's really great. And the bonus is this particular release, this Spanish one, has got a bonus disc that's got another about 16-minute featurette that's exclusive to this release that talks to Brian Bendis, who's the creator of Miles Morales. And it just gives a little bit of the history of why they created the black version of Spider-Man for the comics and how surprised they were that it took off. And I think it's something like, you know, 10 years later, now we have this movie. Like, that's how fast that evolution happened. So it's just terrific. I can't recommend it enough. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Love it, man. Yeah, I got the 4K, but only because I had a Target gift card. But I'm seriously considering getting this as well because it's a huge hit at our house. My daughter loves it. It's one of her favorite movies right now.
Oh,
so
man.
I gotta maybe get this 3D because I didn't see it in 3D in the theater either. So
you're gonna be blown away. Trust
maybe
me.
Clicking on that Spain icon on the old Amazon very soon. okay, so I'm gonna start off with some Criterion action here.
All right.
This is one from Mr. Jim Jarmusch.
Oh.
It is Stranger Than Paradise from 1984.
You sure you don't want a TV dinner?
Yes, I'm not hungry. Why is it called TV dinner?
I'm supposed to eat it while I watch TV. Television.
I know what a TV is. Where does that meat come from?
What do you mean?
What does that meat come from?
I guess it comes from a cow.
From a cow? It doesn't even look like meat.
Ava, stop bugging me, will you? You know, this is the way we eat in America. Mm-hmm. I got my meat. I got my potatoes. I got my vegetables. I got my dessert. I don't even have to wash the dishes.
Well, I don't think that... I think in both films, the characters are not motivated by what one normally expects to see in a story. In both films, they don't have those kind of motivations. I don't really feel that they're organized in Stranger Than Paradise either. I think they do things by chance. Things suggest themselves to them rather than them making decisions, really.
But don't you think whatever they do, it's fine? I mean, they have no fear, even when they are alone, they are strong of being in the middle of nowhere.
Well, they're resigned to that fact. They're resigned to that kind of existence. So it's not something that they think about. They're also not intellectual characters. They find themselves in that world and they accept it. In Permanent Vacation, the character has not quite made the he's not quite decided what his world is. I think there are more possibilities for his world in his mind anyway. I think it's, he doesn't know what will happen in his life. He hasn't resigned himself to anywhere. So in a way, it is the opposite in that he's open to things happening, whereas in Stranger, the characters have already accepted their lives the way they are.
Now, this one, for people that don't know, this is his second film after Permanent Vacation, but I always kind of consider it his first film. I mean, Permanent Vacation is good, and I think it's interesting, and it definitely shows off his style and everything, but this is the movie that really introduced me to Jarmusch. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know his style, it's a very laid-back style. I feel like he said something at some point along the lines of his movies are the in-between bits, you know, like...
I like this, that.
You know, the stuff that, you know, they cut out of movies, more or less. And that's a complete paraphrasing of what they are, and that's an oversimplification, but this movie is fascinating to me and was a huge influence on me in college. It's basically the story of this, like, sort of slacker Hungarian immigrant guy played by John Lurie. His name's Willie, and he's like kind of a layabout. He's a gambler. He's got a friend played by Richard Edson, who I love. And Richard Edson, you would remember from Ferris Bueller's Day Off as the big thing. He's one of the two guys that is the parking lot attendants. Yeah. So there's those two guys and he's one of them. Anyway, and I would bet, and I'm pretty sure this is on the mark, but I would bet that John Hughes is a fan of Jarmusch and this film, and that's probably why he ended up casting him in that movie, but that's just a guess. So it's about Willie and his pal Eddie, and they are visited by Willie's 16-year-old cousin Eva, played by Esther Balint, and she's just, you know, comes to his New York apartment, which is very small, and really cramping his style and playing her Screaming Jay Hawkins tape and, you know, just annoying him in general. And then, you know, they start to click, and it's very, you know, observational. And when I said this is an influence on me, it was the way that he places the camera, which is just setting it up in a room and just kind of letting it go, like one angle, you know, very no camera movement really much at all, except maybe at the occasional tracking shot with a car or something like that, but mostly static camera. So like my first, you know, video project that I did in college, I made it black and white, and I totally shot it in the style of a Jarmusch movie, especially this one. And I did the same thing when I had a Sync Sound 16mm class. I had a lot of shots that I was designing, and my good friend at the time, who was my DP, we were both really into Jarmusch, so we were designing shots, you know, with him in mind. But anyway, this movie is really charming and interesting, and just sort of throws you off because it's just, the pace is very leisurely, to say the least. But I don't know. I really like his stuff. I mean, obviously, he's got a zombie movie coming out with a really great cast. He's done a lot of work since this film.
I couldn't believe that movie was real because they released that trailer on April 1st.
Such an odd choice.
I was convinced it was an April Fool's joke, but it is legit.
Yeah, and I'm very excited to see it because I liked his, you know, take on vampires with The Only Lovers Left Alive, and now I want to see his take on zombies. So anyway, this goes way back and is a really, I think, important and interesting film. And Criterion had released it on DVD, but, you know, now we finally get the Blu-ray, and it looks great. So this has a new audio commentary, new in quotes, because it's actually from 1996. And I think it was originally recorded for a, I guess, scrapped Stranger Than Paradise Laserdisc, or if the Laserdisc came out, it came out without the commentary. So I always find that intriguing when you're listening to people talk from, you know, more than 20 years ago, you know, any references they might make, or basically the people that they are totally different than the people that you would hear from now in some ways. So it's intriguing to hear Jarmusch talking in 1996 about this movie, but it's him and Richard Edson. And I really dug it because this is just a movie I've always wanted to hear more about. So that was cool. And of course, Permanent Vacation, his, you know, 75 minute debut film is on here.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So you get that. And that was on the DVD too, but they ported it over and it's, you know, it looks better here. There's something called Kino 84, Jim Jarmusch, which is a 1984 German television program featuring interviews with the cast and crew members from Stranger Than Paradise and Permanent Vacation. So you have most of the major cast members. You have Tom DiCillo, who would go on to direct Living in Oblivion, among other things. He shot this movie. Unfortunately, Tom DiCillo comes off like a major asshole in this thing. Like, he's just so... I want other people to see it. You can see these features on the Criterion Channel. If you happen to have the Criterion Channel, you can watch Kino 84, Jim Jarmusch. But DiCillo just comes off like he's sort of trying to really take a lot of credit for a lot of the ideas in the film. And they, you know, that may or may not be the case. Like, he may have given Jim a lot of the ideas, but he there's something really kind of snarky and shitty about it that really rubbed me the wrong way, I gotta say.
And that's another thing. I mean, I'm very bored by shooting, I have to tell you that. I'm bored by it. I would like to get the shot done as quickly as possible. I don't think that I have ever, like I said, considered myself a cinematographer. I got into it because of this relationship that I have with Jim. I happen to enjoy looking through the camera, doing things with the camera in some way, but I find it, like I said, very tedious and boring, and I feel like I have a lot of other things that I can do as well, if not better. Okay, and I also feel that it's my experience as an actor that has enabled me to shoot these films the way I've shot them. I think it would be interesting to look at them, especially Stranger Than Paradise. I feel that I shot that film from an acting point of view, and I feel that's one of the reasons why the shots are so alive. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I was bummed because I like Tom DiCillo a lot. Like, I like his films, and Living in Oblivion is one of my favorite movies. So I was just like, "Ah, dude, that's too bad. You sound like an asshole." but whatever, it's still intriguing and a really neat thing to see the cast and everybody talking about the movies right around that time.
Yeah.
And then there's some Super 8 footage and a booklet. You know, it's good. It's a really solid Blu-ray, and it's been a long time coming, so I was really excited to get this one. That's Stranger Than Paradise from Criterion.
Cool. And has Criterion gotten most of this early Jarmusch stuff on Blu-ray at this point? Or they're still, because I know they've put a lot of them out on DVD.
I think they're pretty close with this last month, because they, you know, Permanent Vacation, Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, and then Mystery Train.
And they did Dead Man too, I think, right?
And then Dead Man, and then they just put out Night on Earth. So I think that's basically all his early stuff.
Yeah.
I'm probably blanking on one right now, but they've done right by Jarmusch, which is great. He's a very Criterion kind of guy, so good stuff.
Very cool. Yeah. All right. Next up, I am doubling down on 3D, my man.
Oh, here we go. All right.
I can't help it. I finally got to check out Aquaman 3D.
Oh.
Atlantis has always had a king. Now it needs something more. A hero.
Oh, no.
Your brother is about to declare war. We must stop him.
Sounds like fun.
Let's do it. I'm nobody. But I came to save my home and the people that I love. Miss Crucy.
Aquaman, rated PG-13. Experience it in IMAX December 21st.
So this is James Wan's foray into the DC universe. And I had an absolute blast with it. I love comic book movies. I grew up on all of them. The Marvel Cinematic Universe, and I'm not including the Spider-Man movies because that's technically Sony, and X-Men is with Fox, although Marvel will get to them. But I mean, the regular Marvel Cinematic Universe, the Avengers movies and all those characters, they very rarely make missteps, and when they do, they're so minor that you just enjoy the whole movie. And it's been frustrating to see how many missteps the DC universe has made, because I love Superman, I love Batman, I love Wonder Woman, I love all these characters, and while I liked Justice League, it's obviously far, far less of a movie than it should have been. all things considered. I really don't care about Aquaman, the comic book character. I was never really a fan. And I definitely don't think Jason Momoa is Aquaman when I see him. I'm like, that guy doesn't look like that comic book at all. and now they're on a pretty good streak with, you know, Wonder Woman was pretty good. I liked it quite a bit. And I just saw Shazam, which I really liked a lot. And so this one's probably the most successful at being its own movie, because really what James is doing here is he's like making like a modern underwater, like Flash Gordon. It's just got so much, it's so ambitious. There's so much world building, revolving around Atlantis. And there's also like a tremendous amount of set pieces. Like the whole movie feels like it was designed around these great locations, set pieces, cool aquatic monsters, and kind of this love story between him and the character of, I think her name's Mira, played by Amber Heard. And then you got people like Willem Dafoe, Patrick Wilson is kind of like his rival, Dolph Lundgren's in this movie, Nicole Kidman. I mean, there's just so many wonderful people in it. It's just like a wild action-packed adventure. And because of the way, I mean, look, this whole movie is pretty much filmed on a soundstage and completely CG. So because of that, the 3D is spectacular. And more so, any of the sequences that take place underwater or in Atlantis really, really look terrific. And just the way that things like light up. Some of my favorite 3D discs are actually the documentaries, about like underwater stuff, like the sharks, you know, shark and whale docks and all this other, like kind of the IMAX stuff that they put out on Blu-ray 3D. So that plays really beautifully into this release. There's a review on the back of the box that I love from Empire Magazine that says it's visually wild and recklessly inventive. And that recklessly inventive is like my favorite description ever. Because yeah, it does feel almost like the set pieces are recklessly inventive. So I agree with you, Empire. Now, I bought the UK version of this disc. There is literally no difference between this and the US one because it was released in the US, but really it was price. In the US, I just checked Amazon. When I first checked, it was like $45 for the Blu-ray, the 3D Blu-ray. And now it's currently at $38 on Amazon. This one came to about $20 via Amazon UK. Wow. And it's literally the exact same disc. And it's got over an hour's worth of really cool behind the scenes stuff. I mean, especially when it comes to movies of this sort, I love seeing that stuff. So there's Going Deep Into the World of Aquaman, which explores the making of the movie. They talk to James Wan quite a bit about kind of like, you know, the art direction and designing like all these crazy worlds. Becoming Aquaman is a featurette with Jason Momoa, who kind of talks about Zack Snyder like bringing him in and casting him as this role 5 years ago and it being a secret and he couldn't really talk about it. And there's just tons of stuff. Dark Depths of Black Manta, it goes into like kind of the one of the villains of the movie, and then there's another feature on the creatures, and there's even a 4-minute sneak peek of Shazam. So it's just an action-packed disc from start to finish. It's not great. There's one or two elements of the movie that again, like I always feel like DC gets just one thing wrong. you know, with Shazam, it's like this great kids movie that has hyper-violent things that kids shouldn't see. Like it's like you kind of missed out. You made it really scary for a kids movie. Wonder Woman, I think, is a pretty great movie, except kind of the ending where it turns into a giant CG battle. And this one too, I'm a little mixed on some of the morality choices, but it kind of, you know, it thrusts the narrative of this movie and it creates some of the villains that come after Aquaman. So I guess I get it from a narrative standpoint, but I don't know. Marvel's just much better at finessing their villains, I guess. but this is still a blast.
You know, very cool, man. I am due for a rewatch. I gotta be honest, I didn't love it when I saw it in theaters, but I like you're contextualizing it as like this underwater Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
Which when I think about it makes sense. And I think I just had a lot of baggage, a lot of expectations, and I just am a big fan of James. And so I was just looking for something I think different than what he made, and that's on me. So I'm going to check it out again. My daughter loves it. My daughter's a huge fan. So.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, I mean, look, that's there's nothing wrong with that, because I think going into any, if you go to any movie that's a franchise movie or a sequel or remake, that first watch is really hard, because you have an idea in your head of everything that character, those characters meant to you. And so for me, it always takes two. It always takes two views, because then the second time I can really watch it as its own thing. And that's the thing. I honestly didn't like look at it as, because that guy doesn't look like Aquaman to me.
I know, you're right.
It wasn't Aquaman. I mean, he definitely looks like him by the end. And that's when I'm like, oh, that's kind of awesome. Which is not a spoiler, because it's in the trailer and it's on the damn cover of the box. He actually does get into that ridiculous orange and green outfit. And that's when I start cheering. But if you contextualize and just imagine it as just some crazy fantasy movie, it's kind of cool. And then it becomes that character that you love. So... That's the best way to watch it, for sure.
In Aquaman, there's this kind of 80s movie tone to it. Where did that come from, if that was on purpose?
I really think just growing up as a child of the 80s and 90s, just my love for filmmakers like Lucas and Spielberg, right? And Tim Burton. So when I finally get the chance to make my action adventure film, I think, a lot of what those guys had done had rubbed over me in a big way. And that's just sort of, the spirit that I wanted to make this film with. Mm-hmm. I mean, even down to the musical score, I wanted, my inspiration was Jean-Michel Jarre, Giorgio Moroder. So some very sort of 80s sort of electronica, Vangelis, of course, with what, they did on Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted that kind of flavor. But in terms of sort of the tone and the sort of the visual look, I pulled all that from the comic book.
That makes sense. Next up I have one from Twilight Time here, and that is a little movie called Melvin and Howard from 1980. Now this is a Jonathan Demme film, and one that I was not aware of until, I wish I could remember which commentary, but I owe P.T. Anderson a debt of gratitude for it, because he called it out in either the commentary, and I'm talking DVD here, either the commentary for Hard 8 or maybe Boogie Nights, the original Boogie Nights DVD commentary, which I think got ported over to the, latest Blu-ray that's come out. But he obviously is a big Jonathan Demme fan. I've heard him talk about Demme for years. But Melvin and Howard was one he specifically referenced as a favorite. And it may be one that Tarantino likes as well. And this is a little bit of a long shot, but it opens with a car... what turns out to be a truck driving down a freeway, and the radio is switching, very much like the opening to Pulp Fiction. You're just going, and I know that that's been done in a few different movies, but I can't think of too many movies prior to this one that do it. There's a little bit in Duel, if I remember, Spielberg, dissolves as Dennis. I can't think of the main character of Duel's right now, but like as he dissolves, as the car is driving out further and further away from the city, you hear the radio sort of dissolve, but it's a different effect than actually hearing the radio change, the station change, which is what happens in both Pulp Fiction and this movie. Anyway, that's a, neither here nor there, probably could be nothing, but the story is fascinating because it's based on a true thing. This guy named Melvin Dumar, who was like a milkman and, doer of odd jobs, living in, I want to say, Nevada somewhere. I think it was Nevada. Now I'm blanking on where the movie takes place. But he basically is in the middle of nowhere, and he comes across a guy who's hurt himself riding a bike, a motorbike, around the desert. And the guy claims to be Howard Hughes. Oh. And... so it's Paul Amatt plays Melvin, and Howard Hughes is played by Jason Robards. And so, he picks him up in the desert. He's hurt. Melvin is just a really sweet man, ultimately. So he's like, I'll take you to the hospital. I'll take you. You got to get your arm. And he's like, no doctors. Take me to Las Vegas. Because if it's Howard Hughes, he has hotels in Las Vegas. He wants to go there. So they have a really great, opening scene in the car. It's in Melvin's truck. They're just driving through the night, and Melvin you know, has done this thing where he has sent in his lyrics to a songwriting company, basically a company that will put music to your words. Mm. So he's got this ridiculous song called Santa's Souped Up Santa Sleigh. It's like basically about Santa having a rocket sled that he wrote. Anyway, it's hilarious. So he makes, you know, Howard Hughes sing the song, and he doesn't believe it's Howard Hughes at all. Like, he's just like, whatever, old man, you know.
You want to do me a favor?
It depends on what it is.
Well, I see. I wrote this song. And
no.
It's a Christmas song. You like it. It's called Santa's Souped Up Sleigh.
No.
See, what I did was I had to wrote the words, and then I sent the words into Hollywood Music Company. They make the music up for you. Costs $70, but it's worth it. Here's how it goes. You want to hear it?
No, I don't.
Santa called his elves together to soup up his old sleigh, so Rudolph and the other reindeer could rest on Christmas Day. It's got a million miles to travel and to do it in one day, and that's why Santa Claus has a souped up Santa sleigh.
Enough, sir.
Come on, you haven't even heard the good part yet. It's dramatic narration. It's like Red Sovine. Hey, up there, Batman, what are you doing on my roof? Why, I don't care if you're Santa Claus.
Please stop.
What's the matter?
My ear.
I told you we should have stopped back there.
It's the sound.
What do you mean?
Your song.
Boy, you can be cruel, you know that? Did anybody ever tell you that? You can be real cruel.
I have an aversion to song.
That's what makes you an old asshole. Now just sing along with me. This is the chorus. It's got a rocket burning mighty quick, turning souped up Santa's sleigh. Comes in like a streak of light and it goes out the same way. No, you got it?
No, I don't know.
Listen, man, you sing this or you walk. Okay? It's got a rocket burning mighty quick, turning souped up Santa's sleigh. He's got a rocket burning mighty quick, turn souped up Santa's sleigh. You got it, you're getting it, okay, one more time. He's got a rocket burning mighty quick, turn souped up Santa's sleigh. Hey now, fat man, I told you to get off my roof. That chimney's too small and you're gonna fall. Come on down off that roof. Now this is the last verse. When you hear that rocket roar, you know Santa's on his way. Okay, you ready?
When you hear that rocket roar, you know Santa's on his way.
But he'll be back again next year in a souped-up Santa sleigh.
But he'll be back again next year in a souped-up Santa sleigh.
Hey, that's great, man. Hey, you know what?
What?
You sounded good.
Come on.
You did.
So that's a great scene. I have a little clip of that. But it's just a really enjoyable movie because you start to see... So you get that opening bit of business... And then you go into Melvin's life. You know, he's married to Mary Steenburgen. They live in a trailer park. The marriage is on the rocks. You know, he's not good with money, and things kind of go from there. You know, the story is that, oh man, I don't know how much to give away. But the Howard Hughes thing comes back into play. Let's just put it like that.
Okay.
And there's money involved and some other things. So. It's just a really interesting character drama, basically. But what's intriguing to me, again, is that it's based on, you know, some real stuff. And there's a really nice commentary track that they ported over, I believe, from the old Anchor Bay DVD, because it's with Jonathan Demme and his production designer, Toby Rafelson. And obviously, Demme's no longer with us. I believe it's the same track from the Anchor Bay DVD from years back. But it's great. And the two of them are wonderful to listen to. And it's really neat to hear him go through the movie and say, like, this is the, you know, actual song that Melvin played at his wedding, you know, and just little details that he's thrown in there that he's tried to make it, you know, kind of accurate, but not in a way that's annoying. It's just little extra bits of character that really help the movie. So
Robards actually looks quite beautiful here, even though he's been aged greatly. Mm. He has a very poetic quality to him.
He's so great.
Doesn't he?
Yeah. I, of course, wanted Roberts Blossom to play the part because he'd been in Citizen Ben, and I thought he had that mad look
that,
that would be great.
Yeah, that would have been a good call.
Universal wanted Gary Busey and Jason Robards. They felt that it needed all the help it could get at the box office, and they didn't think that Paul was that much box office, and they certainly didn't know that Robert Blossom's was. So they proposed this trade-off where Paul LaMatte and Jason Robards. So I reluctantly met Jason at a bar in New York, and I fell madly in love with him. It wasn't because I didn't think he was a great actor.
Oh,
I just wanted to use the unknown guy to play the unknown man.
You came up with the perfect combo.
Mm.
Because I think Paul LaMatte is probably more sympathetic than
He looks more. I mean, he looks like Melman.
Yeah.
Gary's got a whole other quality, which is wonderful, but which wasn't that kind of California...
Soft.
Melvin Dumar, Western soft. Thing.
Yeah.
Jason's middle name, by the way, is... No, Howard Hughes. The R is Robard. Howard R. Hughes.
I never knew that.
Yeah.
It's a really neat performance. I love Paul LaMatte as an actor. Mm-hmm. And he's a guy that, outside of American Graffiti and more American Graffiti, people don't really remember him that well. But he's sort of a great, you know, all-American everyman, you know, that can play the flawed character really well. So... he's just very charismatic, and I really like him a lot. So he's great in this. And Robards is great, and Steenburgen is great, and Michael J. Pollard is in it. There's a whole bunch of, like, demi-regulars, like people that just crop up in the movie that are really neat to watch as well. So I don't know. I'm just a big fan of this one, and was very happy to see Twilight Time put it out on Blu-ray. That's Melvin and Howard.
Yeah, I'm pretty unfamiliar with that. It's pretty early, Jonathan Demme, huh? Like 1980?
Yeah, so it's post Citizens Band and a few others, but it's not too far removed from his days with Corman. Mm. So it's, you know, I think it's his first great movie. I think Citizens Band is really cool and fun, and I like it a lot. But I think this is like where he starts really hitting his stride. Is with this movie, and then from here on out, he's just making lots of great stuff. So, yeah, really, really cool early work.
Awesome, man. Okay, so my next pick is this is a fairly recent movie that has just completely slipped off the radar, and I have to bring attention to it. RLJE Films put it out, and it's called Arizona.
What do they teach a seminar to you guys? Just had a lot of people. You didn't say that my house would double in its value in 2 years. Lie.
Say whatever you gotta say to close the deal, don't you?
Hey, buddy.
Would you like to take a tour of my house? My personal gym. This is where the pool's gonna go right here. I'm gonna do a little swim-up bar right there. It's gonna be sexy as hell.
Oh, so these are your kids?
Jason Penn.
That's me.
I'm just gonna say it aloud. Your boss is dead.
Please don't kill me. I have a daughter.
Shut up. Actually, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. I have kids, and that was mean. Here's the plan. We're gonna take Gary's body.
Bodies are, like, super heavy, right?
And we're gonna chop it up. Like civilized people.
Cassie! Cassie! I told you I wasn't gonna kill you!
911, what's your emergency?
There's a man inside there, and he's killed people.
He's got a lot of guns.
Yeah, boy.
So do I.
Damn it! God damn it! Who'd I shoot?
And this is from the producers of Eastbound and Down and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Which is basically the whole, like, David Gordon Green, Danny McBride kind of crew. And it was directed by Jonathan Watson, written by Luke Del Tredici. And Danny McBride is the lead of the movie. And it is set in the housing crisis in Arizona of around 2009, where basically, you know, obviously all these banks lent all this money out to all these people to buy these giant dream houses, and they couldn't afford them. And so people kind of went bankrupt, had to leave, and that's it. And they were just kind of stuck. And so the lead character is actually played by Rosemary DeWitt. And she's a recently divorced single mom now, who's taking care of her daughter, and she works for kind of a really sleazy real estate agent who is one of these many people that conned people into investing in these giant houses, herself included. She actually bought the house from him. And that guy's played by Seth Rogen. So that's kind of hilarious. He's such a scumbag in this. And basically, this town that they live in, it's kind of like a community home, like a gated community home. Barely anybody's left in there. They've all like kind of bankrupt and left. And Danny McBride is one of the people that lives there. He's got a wife and kids that kind of left him. And he has a confrontation with Seth Rogen pretty early on in the movie. It gets violent. He accidentally kills him in a really violent way.
Oh, shit.
And basically McBride takes Rosemary DeWitt hostage because he doesn't know what to do. He's like, all right, well, I guess you saw that. And basically from there, the movie keeps getting even darker and more violent and more fucked up. And it is crazy. And then like you got like Luke Wilson pops into the picture. He's Rosemary DeWitt's ex-husband who has now shacked up with a much, much younger woman. What's his name? David Alan Greer from In Living Color and, you know, longtime great comedian. He pops up as kind of the sheriff. It's just one of those movies that I remember hearing about it on the festival circuit around 2017 or so. Like it was that one of those movies that was playing and everybody was talking about it at the festival. There may be even a little bit of a bidding war to get it. And then they got it and it just came out like months ago. And there's no publicity, nothing. Seth Rogen didn't mention it once or tweet about it. Danny McBride, you know, he was on to other things. Like, I don't know why nobody is publicizing this movie. If I had to describe it, it's the type of humor that you get from Very Bad Things meets like Observe and Report. It's like in that wheelhouse. So okay. if you like really dark, fucked up comedies, this is like, this is a gem of the last couple of years that no one is talking about. So it could be kind of our secret movie if you want. It's super cool. There's not much in way of special features. There's a little Making of Arizona featurette, which is, I don't know, probably 10 minutes long where they do talk to everybody. And I mean, if you want to see Danny McBride as an absolute psycho, he gives an incredible performance here. So I strongly recommend Arizona. It's out on Blu-ray now, obviously. I think it might be on Amazon Prime. So if you want to kind of test the waters there, but I would definitely check out this Blu-ray if you get a chance.
Cool. Yeah, no, I've definitely seen the cover of that one. And I beyond that, I wasn't sure what to make of it. I couldn't even tell if it was a TV show or a movie. So I'm glad you clarified that. And
there's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm not a huge fan of Very Bad Things ultimately, but I do like Observe and Report, and so, you know, putting it in categories with those two is, you know, piqued my interest for sure.
Yeah.
That's cool. Okay, next up I have one from Kino. This is one I've been very excited to come to Blu-ray since Elric and I were able to see a rep screening of it when we were in New York last summer.
Oh.
And that is The Landlord from 1970. Oh.
Wealthy Elgar Enders never had the chance to live in a slum, so he bought one.
Bonton Heights, that's his official name, will start a trend in urban renewal, Mr. Enders.
This neighborhood's going to be very chic, very chic. Let's hope this influx of the beautiful people is the beginning of an inclination.
What is this we have here?
I'm Elgar Enders, the new landlord.
You follow this right there, Monkey.
Are you the new landlord?
I own this house. I'm the new landlord.
You have until the count of three.
I am the new landlord.
These arrows have been dipped in Fanny's barbecue sauce.
Cigarette pops?
Likely to meet my son.
My heavens, it's good to meet you.
Hi.
I'm Elgar Enders.
My name's Laney.
William Jr.
William Jr.
Peter.
Are you with Vista? Is this some sort of a new program or something?
No. That's Elgar.
You think I'm white, don't you?
This real estate is very important to me. It's the most important thing I've ever done. I'm a Cancerian, and home is very important.
You're a Leo.
No, Mother, I'm a Cancer.
When were you born?
The roof leaks. The toilet runs all day.
I'm going to put in a patio right here.
My, it's hot in here.
It's really cool, Mr. Enders.
You awful cute to be a landlord.
Oh?
The Mirage Production Company presents The Landlord.
Okay? Okay!
Starring Pearl Bailey as Marge, Diana Sands, Lee Grant, and Beau Bridges as The Landlord.
This is Hal Ashby's debut film, and it stars Beau Bridges, Lee Grant, Pearl Bailey, Susan Anspach, and it's got a younger Hector Elizondo, as well as Lou Gossett Jr. So basically, this is the story of, you know, a rich young guy, played by Beau Bridges, who he leaves his family's estate in Long Island to basically I think he buys like a tenement apartment building in Park Slope, mm-hmm. and it, which is a, at the time it's mostly a black neighborhood, and it's intriguing because Park Slope has now become like really high end, you know, gentrified part of the New York you know, landscape. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Yeah,
you're from
back
east, so you know that. But for those that didn't know that, yeah, it's so that it's intriguing that that's where this starts. But basically, it's a very, you know, edgy comedy dealing with race, because Beau Bridges' character comes into this tenement building, is basically like, I'm the landlord now, and you guys are out. I'm gonna gut this whole place, and of course, there's a whole bunch of, you know, black families in the apartment buildings that are like, no, dude, we're not leaving. And then it becomes sort of a warring factions kind of thing. And then they sort of bond with each other, but it's never like touchy feely, like, aren't we all great? It's very on the edge the whole time, because the family he comes from is pretty racist and very upper class white. And he's trying to be more progressive, and he achieves a little bit, but he ends up, you know, showing his ignorance in a lot of other ways. So it's like one of those sort of dumb rich guy movies. But Beau Bridges is very good, and there's a lot of very interesting editing. You know, obviously, for those that don't know, Hal Ashby started as an editor with Norman Jewison and on stuff like The Cincinnati Kid, and there was a couple others. And so he does a lot of cool little bits of editing, little flashes of, you know, things throughout. I won't spoil any of those. They're actually pretty funny for the most part. They're definitely edgy, but it's a really neat sort of counterculture kind of movie, progressive and still relevant, I think, in a lot of ways, even as, I don't know, un-PC as it might come off now. Anyway, so I don't know. I like this movie a lot. I think it's a really sort of remarkable debut film in a lot of ways, and definitely worth looking at. It had only gotten a DVD-R release on DVD within the past 5, 6, 7 years, but prior to that had just had VHS, and just really hasn't been that available to this point. Isn't really streaming that I could find, you know, so it seems like nowadays when something's not streaming, it's basically out of the conversation unless you're paying attention to this stuff. So I do recommend you pick this movie up if you're a Hal Ashby fan. The special features include new interviews with Beau Bridges. That's about 25 minutes. There's a Lee Grant interview, about 26 minutes. And then my favorite, I think, of all the interviews was the Norman Jewison interview. They talked to him. It's about 30 minutes. So you have almost an hour and a half, almost a commentary's worth of interviews. But the Jewison stuff is great because he talks about meeting Hal Ashby and their like early work together, and how he basically was going to direct this movie himself, but then, you know, he gave it to Hal to direct. And it's a really touching story because he talks about basically cradle to the grave in terms of their relationship, when he met him right up until he dies, and his feelings about it. You can see he's getting kind of emotional by the end. And so it's a powerful interview, and I really liked it a lot. But the movie itself is one that I think is really not in the conversation as much as it should be, considering how interesting it is and how timely. So definitely worth a look, and hats off to Kino for putting this one out. That's The Landlord.
Wow, man, you're hitting me with a lot of titles I've never seen before. So this is good. Good stuff.
Cool.
All right, my next one is a fairly recent movie that I think is fantastic. It's the latest from Spike Lee, Black Klansman.
This is David Duke.
Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. That David Duke?
You're darn tootin'.
The KKK is planning an attack.
I'm telling you, the wars are coming.
How do you propose to make this investigation?
We'll establish contact over the phone.
We'll need a white officer to play me when they meet face to face.
You for the white race, Ron?
Oh, hell yeah.
Can you do that?
With the right white man, we can do anything.
Black Klansman in cinemas August 24.
Have you seen this yet?
I have.
Oh, man. So I missed it in theaters, but I got this Blu-ray. And I got to tell you, I really think I was kind of blown away by it. I really think it's one of Spike Lee's best, or definitely one of the best that he's done in the last decade or so.
Oh, for sure.
It's based on a true story about Ron Stallsworth, based on his book, also called Black Klansman, slightly different spelling, though. And it's about his true life story of how he was in the 1970s, detective, the first African-American detective in the Colorado Springs Police Department, and how one day he's flipping through ads in a paper, sees a very overt ad for the Ku Klux Klan, decides to call it up, and basically poses as a white man trying to join the Klan. And so when it comes time for them to meet him, the actual live version of this character that he's created, he kind of enlists his one of his partners there, Flip Zimmerman, played by Adam Driver, who's amazing in this movie, kind of be the live action version of him. And so it's basically about these guys that just inadvertently join the Ku Klux Klan. And the thing about it is we're talking about a subject that is rooted in reality and is very, especially nowadays, a very hot topic, button pusher. And you need to deal with this in this kind of material in a very sensitive manner. And yet I found it hilarious. I think what Spike did was like, you're waiting for, it's a very intense situations and usage of, words I'm not very comfortable with that usually would make anyone uncomfortable. And he's deflating these sequences and these terrible things with such incredible humor, like the way he orchestrates the humor of it all. And hats off this whole cast because they're all really, really terrific, including Topher Grace, who plays David Duke.
Yeah, he is really good too.
It's like, oh my God, it's unbelievable. And the power of it really lies. I mean, I gotta be honest with you. I think the thing that really drives it home is the ending. And obviously, I'm not going to give away the ending now, but that's the thing is you're brought on this ride, and basically the idea that the everyone around them, like Ron, recognizes that this is a terrible threat that should be watched and monitored, or else it's going to bubble up and eventually get out of control. The idea that they're these people that are rooted in racism and plotting kind of white supremacy, like to try to change things in a very negative way. And basically everyone kind of brushes it off like, no, this is not a big deal. It's they're just hot air. They're not going to do anything. And just when you think it can't get bad, I mean, like he basically beautifully loops it into current time events, like real news footage of what's stuff that's happening now. And it's such a gut punch, man. It's like that to me made the whole movie. That's why it's one of his best movies. Is it's this great story, it's this crazy story, and then to kind of tie it into current events and really show that not much has changed, and it's really shines a spotlight on people, and it's like, God, as a society, can we change? Because it's quite something, I gotta tell you. And again, it's been a while since a movie hit me on so many emotional nerves as this one did. So I really loved it. I especially love the female lead is let me check her name again. I think it's Laura Hara. Let me see, I have it handy here a second. Yeah, Laura Harrier, who we'd first seen in well, not first, but I recognize her from Spider-Man Homecoming. She played the Liz Allen character, kind of like his love interest. And she's just terrific in this, and just like one of those actresses that, you know, is probably going to just be doing huge movies for a long time. But anyway, the Blu-ray's great. It's got only a couple of special features, very short. I was hoping for a commentary, but it doesn't have a commentary. There's a quick segment called the Spike Lee Joint, and it's only about 5 or 6 minutes long, but you get to hear from the real Ron Stallsworth, Jordan Peele, who's a producer on this, and how he basically recruited Spike Lee to take on this story. And then there's an extended trailer that features the Prince song, Mary, Don't You Weep. So all in all, a great disc, great movie. And I'm really proud to have it in my collection.
Yeah, I'm with you. Definitely one of his best in a long time and one of the best movies from last year. And that ending is, yeah, like you say, really, really, it really drives things home in a way that I didn't expect, you know.
Yeah,
from this
movie,
so.
And that's the power of really good cinema. You know, it's like if you can tie things in and really make your audience feel something emotional, and it really did get me. So yeah, kudos, Spike Lee. I'll toast to you, sir.
Absolutely. All right. So next up, I have another one from Kino. And with this one, I'm bringing Jarmusch back. I'm going to double down on Jarmusch this episode.
Right on.
So this one is almost 20 years from Stranger Than Paradise. It's just a little bit more than that. This is from 2005, and it is Broken Flowers.
Oh, wow.
Dear Don, years ago, I had a son. Your son, no return address.
You have no idea who this is from?
Nope.
Congratulations, you're a father.
You give me a list of all your girlfriends, and then I can plan everything.
You go visit them.
And look for clues about your son. Photographs, ink stationery. Find that typewriter. And then I can forensically match the type to the letter.
You're insane, Winston.
Words disappear. Words once so clear.
Donnie, is that you? What are you doing here?
It's me, Don.
Oh, Don.
Women and women and women.
Want to get a drink?
No, I don't drink.
Maybe get something to eat?
I don't eat.
Take a walk? I know you walk.
I don't feel like it.
What do you want, Donnie?
Do you have a son?
Are you okay?
It was just a minor misunderstanding.
So this one stars Bill Murray, and the cast is actually really great, but Bill Murray basically plays a dude who made his money in computers, I think. They make reference to it a few times, like he had a computer-based company, and I think he sold it, so he's doesn't really have to worry about money, but he's not really satisfied, and he gets, well, you get a sense that he's got some ennui or something. And he gets this letter in the mail. It's like this pink envelope in the letter, and it's written, and it says that this woman who doesn't name herself is claiming to have had a relationship with him at some point, like 20 years ago, and that she tells him in the letter that after they parted ways, she found out she was pregnant and decided to raise the kid on her own, and it's a boy, and that he may come looking for Bill Murray's character. But he's got a really energetic neighbor played by Jeffrey Wright, who is really intrigued by the whole mystery of this letter. And he's like, dude, I want to help you find out what this is. And Bill Murray's kind of like, I don't want to, you know, I don't know, man. And he's like, just give me a list of, you know, all your old flames. And Bill Murray apparently got kind of busy with the ladies. So it's a handful of women. He finally, you know, sort of acquiesces and gives Jeffrey Wright a list. And then Jeffrey Wright, you know, through the internet, tracks down all these women and says, like, here's where they live. I've gotten you plane tickets to go and visit them. You can go and look for a typewriter, which is what the letter was written on. So that might be a giveaway. So you can try and figure out who this is. And I can't remember how, but he convinces Murray to do it, even though Murray's like, this could all be a joke. Like, who knows if this is even real? But I guess he's looking for that little spark, that little something. And so he starts going back through his old relationships with these women. And it's a lovely parade of talented actresses, you know, from Sharon Stone to Frances Conroy to Jessica Lange and Tilda Swinton. And it's really interesting because you don't really get much in terms of hearing the history of these relationships, except what comes out in conversation between him and these women now. And so it's really intriguing to sort of piece things together. And the movie, not to spoil anything, but, you know, it may or may not want to give you definite answers as to who it is and what's happening. And I really like that about it. I like the way it ends, and I think it's a really great performance by Bill Murray. It's one of his, I mean, he obviously done some dramatic performances prior to this, but this is one of my favorites of his sort of dramatic turns in the past, you know, 20 years. And he just plays it really well. Are you familiar with this one? Have you seen it?
No, I don't think I have, actually. I love Jarmusch, but there's a few nuggets here and there that I've missed. And both of the ones you mentioned today are ones I haven't seen. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I'll have to really get this one.
I think you dig it. I think you dig it. Murray's really good in Jarmusch Land. Like, he also has a small part in Coffee and Cigarettes, which I think is an interesting...
Yeah, I've seen that one.
You know, he's got a couple good scenes, or a good scene in that one. There's a bunch of vignettes in that. But anyway, this is a little bigger role for Bill Murray, and I like it. It's kind of neat. It's the Blu-ray has some extended scenes, and then it had this thing called the Farmhouse featurette, which features a neat phone interview with Jim Jarmusch, which is cool because he kind of gives his take on the movie, and you don't hear him talking about his movies that much. Like, he does some interviews and some press, but I don't know. I guess he's the kind of guy that I find so mysterious in his own way in terms of what's going on in his movies and, you know, where he's coming from, that I just sort of lap up any little bit of him talking about him. So that's a neat little interview that's on this disc.
I like to make scenes that where you have no idea what's going to happen next. It's not a formula, you know? Well, it is something that echoes through, I guess, my other films, because it's such a valuable part of life to me, which is randomness and just chance and coincidence. It's really, these things guide our lives, not... You know, you can plan things out as much as you want, but the most beautiful, deep things in our lives are not rational. They're usually emotional, or they're connections with other people, and those things are very mysterious. So those things, they add up to a whole fabric of life for me, and I've always tried to make films that were... I don't know, it's sort of like chaos theory, you know, things don't happen in a rational way, they happen in a more of an emotional way, or a random way, or by molecules in the universe moving in a way we don't control, you know?
But yeah, this is the first time this movie's been available on Blu-ray, as far as I can tell, and that's kind of crazy, because I feel like all his stuff should be available, so... Anyway, that's Broken Flowers from Kino.
All right. Cool. Well, let's see. For my fifth and final selection, plus my runner-up coming up soon, this is a Shout Select title, which I liked when it came out. Then I revisited this Blu-ray. I wasn't sure if I liked it. Now that I think about it, I do like it. And I'm talking about Christian Slater in Cuffs.
Nice.
The Patrol Special is a private security force. An elite group of seasoned crime fighters.
All right, all right!
Everyone a professional. Except this one.
Howdy. I never really saw myself as a cop. I'm more like the bad guys.
Why are we doing so much running? Aren't we all gonna be in cars?
I'm looking for a really big gun that holds a lot of bullets.
Move it!
The first time you screw up, you're out of business.
I'm doing all right.
He's a kid.
Wait, I am not a kid. Calm down.
Kid.
Where'd you learn to shoot like that?
Never shot a gun before in my life. Maybe this isn't so hard after all.
Wait a minute, everybody.
But we all decided we don't want you as our boss.
You just have to take charge. Yeah, come in, 10-4.
Just checking in, boss.
Surprise the bad guys?
Ah, we're gonna die, Sam! Oh, I scared you, didn't I?
And send your girl flowers.
And what would you like the card to say?
Dear Maya, it was great seeing you the other night. Love and kisses on all your pink parts.
Draw under arrest. Lay down on the ground or something.
He's not a patrol special. He's a screw-up.
Got women to do, places to see. Going down.
Yeah. Have you seen this lately, or did you get this?
I did,
disc?
Actually. You had texted me about it, and I was like, you know, he might talk about this on the show, and I was thinking about getting the Blu-ray myself, but I haven't yet. But I did have it digitally, so I did rewatch it. And
I think I said, this isn't nearly as good as I remember. I think that was my text to you.
I think so, yes.
And now I kind of take it back. It really is good.
Yeah, no, and I went in lower based on your, you know, what you're offering there. And I did enjoy it. I do like what he's doing in this movie. I mean, you can go ahead and explain it, but I think it's pretty fun.
It's a really silly movie. I mean, this is from 1992. And it's basically, so he plays a character named George Cuffs. He's like this young hotshot guy. And it's kind of like peak Christian Slater at this point, right? You know, he'd pump up the volume. He'd done, he's just gleaming the cube. He was kind of like, you know, in his prime right here. And basically it's kind of almost like a Beverly Hills Cop knockoff, sort of. They even have the same composer, so that's why the music sounds a lot like Axel Foley's theme song.
Walter Meyer.
Yes. Walter Meyer, who is on this disc, by the way.
Sweet.
But anyway, so his older brother is a policeman who owns a district. I've never actually heard of this, but I watched the special features and apparently this is a real thing. So he kind of owns the district that he governs over, and he crosses the wrong person, he gets killed. And all of a sudden, George Cuffs decides he wants to change the trajectory of his life. He didn't want to take any responsibility. He has this young girlfriend who's Mila Jovovich, and she's like 15 years old in this movie.
Oh my God.
Which is kind of crazy, which makes it even more awkward because he gets her pregnant. He doesn't know if he wants to be a dad, and he's like, I don't know what I'm doing with my life. And then once
that's
his brother...
That's a tough opening scene, by the way, because he really shoots himself in the foot in terms of likability right out of the gate.
Yeah, you're kind of like, and I mean, she's not supposed to be 15 in the movie. Like, I think they're trying to age her up.
Yeah.
But she still looks really young. And it's like, man, this guy is really douchey and doesn't want to take any responsibility. But anyway, basically, his brother's death kind of convinces him that he wants to take over his district, even though he never finished high school. He doesn't have any sort of police training or anything. He decides that he's going to be a police officer and take over his brother's district. And so that's exactly what he does. They pair him up with a new partner played by Tony Goldwyn, who is fearless in this movie. And basically he's after like this art dealer dude. I don't even know what his gimmick is, but all I know is that the art dealer dude that's responsible for everything and kind of muscling everyone in town has a very flamboyant best friend, Hitman, who wears some really interesting, questionable 80s-style clothes in a movie made in the 90s. In fact, there's one scene that I tweeted that he's wearing a T-shirt with a photo of himself printed on the T-shirt. And I was just like, I don't know how much more meta we could get here. I don't know too many hitmen that make T-shirts with their face on it. It's not very subtle. But whatever. It's goofy. It's funny. He breaks the fourth wall a lot. And so I remember at the time, I just loved Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And so it just reminded me of that. I was like, oh, cool. Christian Slater's kind of an Axel Foley-ish cop who's not really a cop. And he's breaking the fourth wall and talking to camera and stuff. I will say the trailer is really great still. There's stuff in the trailer that's really, really funny to me. I don't know why I laugh, but when he's like, put your guns down and put your hands up or something. Like, I don't know why. Like, the way he delivers that is pretty funny to me.
Yeah, he's got a lot of little off-the-cuff, sorry, no pun intended, deliveries in the movie that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, and I mean, it's Christian Slater who had that really cool likability. He was like kind of channeling, you know, young Jack Nicholson and doing his own thing. So I don't know. I think this is kind of a fun movie. Shout did a pretty good job on the disc. I wish Christian Slater was on it, but instead they got a conversation with Bruce A. Evans and Reynold Gideon, who I believe is the co-writer director and the co-writer producer. They're the guys that put this project together. together, and they kind of talk about, there's a lot of interesting things they talk about in the movie, in terms of how it all kind of came together. I think one of them just had heard that this had actually, it was kind of culled from a newspaper article where they read about somebody taking over a district. Because I think what it was is like, there's certain, towns or districts that, don't have enough money for a police force. And so they designate or vote somebody within the community to kind of, govern it for them. So it's loosely based on in truth. And you know, they just give a lot of fun stories. The director was kind of embarrassed by it because it didn't do well and didn't come out the way he thought it should. And yet he revisited it for this disc and was like, oh, it's much better than I remember. and they even referenced that, recently Christian Slater had done some interview on a red carpet or whatever. And someone had said, if there was any movie you wanted to make a sequel to, what would it be? And without even a hesitation, he said, Cuffs. So,
oh, wow.
So I thought that was so bizarre that even he kind of,
well, and then they couldn't get him, you know, I mean, obviously he maybe he's busy or whatever, but has some fondness for the movie, which is neat.
Yeah, no, he definitely does. It was probably just a scheduling thing, I imagine.
Sure,
But, and there's also, I haven't listened to it yet, but they also both did a commentary for the feature film. So I'll get to that eventually because their stories are really good. And even just kind of contextualizing Christian Slater, because I think he's the one, there might have been some other person that they cast for it, but really it was him who made it happen. And not only that, he was so busy, they had to wait something like 2 or 3 movies for him. Like, he literally had to shoot 3 movies before he could do Cuffs, something like that.
Wow.
So no, it's a cool disc, and you know, whatever, I have a soft spot for Cuffs.
Yeah. It was one of those that I think became sort of a home video favorite. I remember one of my coworkers at the video store I used to work at in college, he was a big fan of it. It was in his employee picks, I think, at one point. And there was definitely, he would throw lines at me from it every once in a while because I knew the movie and enjoyed it. But it was fun to revisit. I'm glad you reminded me of it. I'm glad Shout put it out.
Look, I was 16 years old when this movie came out. It was, you know, it was perfect for a 16-year-old.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I agree with that. All right, well, simpatico, here we go. I have a Shout Select disc myself.
Oh, nice.
Next in my stack, and that is one of my favorite disaster films ever made, and that is Earthquake from 1974.
Universal has given Earthquake its maximum effort, starting with a story and screenplay written by George Fox and Mario Puzo, author of The Godfather. Universal has enriched this fascinating drama of interwoven lives with a superb cast. Charlton Heston, Ava Gardner, George Kennedy, Lorne Greene, Genevieve Bujold, Richard Roundtree, Marjo Gortner, Barry Sullivan, plus the city of Los Angeles and its millions of people living, loving, planning, fighting until nature's most violent upheaval forces them to battle and claw for life itself.
Jim. Stuart Graff. She's dying again. Yeah, I think we'll get faster action if you call me.
I have to go to Oregon this summer. All summer on a hydroelectric project. Come up there.
They indicate another pre-shock, probably before noon today.
And if it happens?
Then the big one follows in 48 hours.
If this dam busts, there won't be nothing between here and Wilshire Boulevard left to burn!
So, this is a really nice Blu-ray because Shout has included, it's a 2-disc set, so they've got a new 2K scan of the original film elements for both versions, and by both versions I mean the original theatrical cut of the film and then a extended television version of the film. It's extended by about 20 minutes. And
that movie doesn't need 20 more minutes, let me tell you.
No, it doesn't necessarily. In fact, I will say, before I really get into it, that the TV version I'm probably not going to watch again because it doesn't, in terms of what they add to the movie, there's a couple different plot lines, one of which is just like this couple on an airplane flying over and into Los Angeles and then getting out of Los Angeles. It feels a little cheap. But then there's also some other stuff that ties into the real movie, this Marjo Gortner stuff, which is a little darker and stranger that I don't know. It was interesting. It was just interesting to have it. I think it's neat because this was a television event on, I think, ABC. I want to say ABC. No, NBC. It was a two-night event. It was like a Sunday and a Sunday or something. And they broke it into, you know, two sections. And so it's interesting because it fades out at the end of this first section. And then they kind of show the credits again. And they kind of recap a little bit. And then they get back into the back end of the movie. But anyway, that's just a nice little extra added bonus. I just love Earthquake. I already owned Earthquake on Blu-ray, but I was definitely happy to get it again because I really do think it's one of the great disaster films. For me, it's like Poseidon Adventure, Towering Inferno, Earthquake are, you know, three of the greats from the 70s stuff. I also really love Roller Coaster, but I know a lot of people don't like that one as much. But it's a wonderful combination of practical effects, matte paintings, miniatures, great practical stunt work, all combining to give this feeling of real destruction. So it's a weird mix of a movie that is like campy in parts because it stars Charlton Heston. I mean, it's got the all-star cast. It's Charlton Heston, Ava Gardner, George Kennedy, Lauren Green, Genevieve Bugeaud, Richard Roundtree, Marjo Gortner, Barry Sullivan, Victoria Principal. Walter Matthau has an incredible cameo that a lot of people forget about where he's just like this drunk in a pimp hat, like a purple silk pimp hat in a bar. And he almost has no dialogue. He's just literally drinking in this bar as the earthquake is going off. It's bizarre. But anyway, I just, the effects and everything really, I find still pretty effective in terms of the way that it makes me feel. I don't know. Like I said, it's harrowing in spots because of all those things, especially because they're really killing people. There's a lot of people dying, falling out of buildings, getting shit dropped on them. And like I said, there's all kinds of stunt work happening in this along with all the other stuff. The matte paintings are by the great Albert Whitlock, who, you know, would go on to do things like The Thing. Like, he does a lot of the great spaceship stuff in The Thing, I believe, and just one of the great matte painters of all time. Like, you look at his stuff and you can see like what he could add to. I just love the idea, especially in this world we live in now of CG and whatnot, that you could really carry off an environment or, you know, a location or destruction of a location through a painting. A real, you know, real life looking painting. And he just did a great job with that, you know. And they show, one of the featurettes shows like the before and after, like basically what he painted and what they matted around. And you can see some of the shots like are mostly him. And they're some of the most effective shots in the movie because they're showing LA just completely destroyed. But anyway, other interesting facts about this movie. Co-written by Mario Puzo, the Godfather. So that's interesting. Music by John Williams. Stars Richard Roundtree as an Evel Knievel type stunt bike rider. And it stars Marjo Gortner as, like, I don't know if he's supposed to be a disturbed Vietnam vet, but he's like a guy who works at a grocery store who also works for the National Guard, who completely loses his shit when he starts stalking the Victoria Principal character. But when the earthquake happens, he just he goes off the deep end. And so that's kind of a weird thing. But the major thrust of the plot is Charlton Heston, I think he works at an architectural firm because he's dealing with, you know, talking about building safety and, you know, earthquake safeguards. And it's really funny because he's married to Ava Gardner, and I want to say they were relatively the same age, but her dad is played by Lauren Green, and I think he was only like 8 years older than her or something like that. Like, so it's kind of a weird mix where he's, you know, trying to deal with her and she's his dad. I don't know. It's, that's strange to me, but it's all adds to the charm of the movie for me ultimately, you know? So it's just a lot of fun. Like I said, when there's silly parts to it, but there's a lot of crazy death in the movie that makes it, I don't know, feel like a real disaster. Like, you know, and living in California, I think I'm always intrigued by earthquakes. I've obviously been through a few, nothing too big, knock wood.
Yeah.
But it's just something you think about. You know, like, we're always talking about the big one. When does it happen? And this is a movie that is ostensibly about that and the real destruction it could cause. So I don't know. I like it. I I get hooked into it by the end, and I really get into it. So the featurettes here, there's an Albert Whitlock featurette, I think I mentioned. Mm-hmm. The guy in this featurette said something really remarkable. He said that the Earthquake was 9 months from conception to release, which is insane.
The whole movie?
The whole movie. Conception before shooting and pre-production to the release when it came out was 9 months.
Yeah.
So that's insane right there. But this whole featurette, it goes through the Whitlock's process. This guy knew him really well. And it's a really neat breakdown of that kind of old guard special effects. I really like it a lot. There's a featurette on Sensoround by Ben Burtt, who I think is an expert in this kind of... He's an Academy Award winning sound designer, and he does... I think I was just hearing he did some intros at the TCM Film Festival, and everybody was singing his praises. And it was really neat because he goes through what Sensoround was, just in case you don't know. And I mean, the basics of it was that it was like these giant speakers that they'd put in a theater that would literally shake the theater when certain things were happening. Basically, there was something on the soundtrack, like a high frequency that the speakers would pick up on and then start rumbling. So I don't know. But he goes through the whole history of it. It's really neat. I just am fascinated by that stuff. And then I think there's a featurette on John Williams' music as well. And there was some audio interviews, I want to say, with some of the cast. Why am I not seeing that on the back? Maybe I'm thinking of a different movie. I'm blanking now, but... Oh, you know, yeah, audio interviews with the cast. Yeah, there's like... I want to say like Heston maybe and Lauren Green or something. I think they're archival audio interviews, which are interesting too. But I love me some Earthquake. If you're a disaster movie fan, it's a must own, and I think it's worth getting over the old Blu-ray, because I think it looks a little better, and it's got the TV version and everything. And these featurettes are really cool. I really had a good time with it. So it's a really great release from Shout Select. That's Earthquake.
Wow. Well, I guess I got to get that because, look, good or bad, I love those disaster movies. Poseidon Adventure, I own the damn Swarm. Towering Inferno, that's a great one. And this falls somewhere in between. So I think I got to get Earthquake, yeah.
I think you'll dig it.
Well, that was an eclectic five, as was mine. And just a quick runner-up for you. I'm going to triple down on 3D if my runner-up counts.
Yes.
I am on brand, man. No, you know what? Again, it's like because 3D stuff is getting harder to get, I'll be out and about. And I picked up Minions on 3D a while back and didn't realize that it was kind of a semi-sequel to a franchise already. So I've never watched it. I've been waiting to get the Despicable Me movies. And I managed to score the second one, but obviously I'm not going to jump into a sequel. And what really motivated me was, I think it was when I talked about Megamind on one of our earlier shows. The trailer on it was for Despicable Me, and the trailers are all in 3D. The 3D was just spectacular. I mean, some of the animated 3D stuff that they put out there just looks so good. And so I literally just kind of shopping in a used store, I found the first Despicable Me for $5 in 3D. And I could not pass it up, picked it up. I've since ordered the third one from Amazon UK because the third one's only available in 3D in the UK. So I will have my complete Despicable Me collection before you know it. But this first movie is absolutely adorable, and I love it so much. Steve Carell plays this, where he voices the lead character, Gru, who's kind of fancies himself as one of the greatest supervillains of all time, until this kind of young guy shows up named Vector, who is voiced by, I believe it's Jason Segel. Yeah, voices him and kind of steals his thunder. And so he has this grand plan to shrink and steal the moon, which is absolutely ridiculous.
I'm applying for a new villain loan. Go by the name of Vector. It's a mathematical term, a quantity represented by an arrow with both direction and magnitude. Vector! That's me, because I'm committing crimes with both direction and magnitude. Oh, yeah! Check out my new weapon. Piranha gun! Oh, yes! Fires live piranhas. Ever seen one before? No, you haven't. I invented it. Do you want a demonstration? Shit. So difficult sometimes to get the drone back inside of my...
But he's got to get this ray back, and he basically, the only way to get to Vector's place is he notices that he has a soft spot for cookies and lets these Girl Scouts in. They're orphans, and Gru decides to adopt these orphans and realizes maybe he's not such a bad guy, and he kind of maybe likes these orphans, and maybe he likes being a dad. I don't know. It's adorable. Oh, by the way, he has these little minions that work for him. They're these cute little, I don't even know how to describe them. I don't know if they're supposed to be an animal or something, but they're these little yellow guys. They're cute. I loved it. The 3D is just spectacular, man. Again, things like Megamind, Incredibles 2, all these animated movies just really, they take full advantage of the 3D, like with the stuff that's coming straight at you. Not only did I love this movie, I now understand all the Agnes gifts that my fiance sends to me, because that's one of the little girls, and she's adorable. Also, it was really funny, I don't mind saying this to you, but because Gru is kind of a tall, lanky, bald dude. And when I discovered that, when I watched the 3D one, Alyssa, my fiance, rewatched it as well. I forget the title in France, but it's a pretty funny title. And she's like, you remind me of Gru so much. You're like, you're grumpy and you hate kids, but really you're a beautiful person deep down. And I'm just like, thanks, I think. But I'll take it.
Sure. No, Gru is a charmer, ultimately. So I think it's a compliment.
It's a compliment. So that's my runner-up. Despicable Me, 3D.
No, that's great. I'm a big fan. And I think I just snagged that on 3D as well, maybe? Or maybe it was one of the sequels. I can't remember. I feel like Big Lots had one of them.
Yeah.
Maybe it wasn't that. Maybe I'm confusing it. But I have yet to watch it in 3D, so I need to. But it's a really... I don't think the sequels stack up quite as well, although they do have some fun stuff in them. But I really like the first movie quite a bit. I think it's a blast. So I'm glad you got around to that one.
Oh, yeah.
My bonus is another Shout Factory title. This is Scream Factory. And I've been doing a lot of these monster movies lately, the 50s stuff, and this is Tarantula.
Ooh.
From 1955.
But what if circumstances were to magnify one of them in size and strength, took it out of its primitive world and turned it loose in ours? Then expect something that's fiercer, more cruel and deadly than anything that ever walked the earth.
Even science was stunned. The new atomic miracle should have been mankind's greatest boon. Instead, when such power to cause phenomenal growth proved dangerously unstable, man was confronted with his most shocking blunder.
The isotope triggered our nutrient into a nightmare.
A blunder that transformed a tiny insect into the 100-foot spider that was now ravaging the panic-stricken countryside.
This is one of my favorite of the sort of Atomic Age monster movies, and it's got a really awesome climactic scene where this giant spider attacks a house and just tears it apart. And overall, they do a solid job with the effects in terms of the spider itself, where they're comping the spider, the tarantula, into scenes. I mean, it's that basic thing of filming a real animal and comping it into scenes, but they're able to do where the spider's feet step. Somehow they were able to match the matting in a way that makes it look like it's really in the space, and so I just thought that helps a lot in keeping you in a movie. The story is basically of like a lone wolf scientist who's like off in this mansion in the desert, and he has been working on this like formula, and it ends up fucking him up and some other people in different ways, but then it also has the effect of making giant creatures. But it's a lot of fun and kind of not scary, but as scary as this kind of thing can be in parts, you know. I think it's a good double with Them, which is a even more harrowing, you know, 50s sci-fi movie, probably my favorite of that period. But it's good if you like this kind of stuff. It's one of the better entries in that sort of arena. It's got a commentary by film historians Tom Weaver, Dr. Robert J. Kiss, and David Schechter, which is good stuff, and even includes a clip of Joe Dante talking about the movie, which might be from his Trailers from Hell, or maybe it's just something along... He has a great story about going to the movies with his dad, or getting his dad to take him to see Tarantula.
This came out in 1955. I remember I begged my dad to take me to see this picture because it was only playing on Wednesday and Thursday. And I managed to drag him out to sit through this giant insect movie that was so scary that I spent most of my time in the lobby pacing, worried, terrified that I to go back and look at the giant spider, leaving my father alone in the auditorium watching a giant spider movie that I'm sure was the last thing he wanted to do. I remember the manager pointing me out to somebody else and laughing. I'm like, ah, fuck, this kid can't take it.
So there's a great, Joe Dante has a great story about that and his dad staying in the theater to watch it. But it's mostly Tom Weaver, who's been a part of a lot of Universal horror movies.
Yeah.
He does the commentaries on those. So he's solid. He talks about having gone through a lot of old Jack Arnold interviews and realized that Jack Arnold is basically full of shit like crazy when it came to the history of his productions. So Weaver never had any desire to interview him in person because he was just like, well, he would just fed me some line of bullshit, basically. Which, you know, just one of those things, like sort of a print the legend kind of guy, I guess Jack Arnold was. Obviously he of the Creature from the Black Lagoon and others. David Schechter comes in and he'll just cut in, like, you know, he'll introduce other people in the commentary. So Schechter comes in for like 11 minutes to talk about the music of the movie, and Robert J. Kiss cuts in later to talk about Universal's approach to the theatrical release of the movie and stuff like that. So I don't know. It's kind of cool. Just overall, it was a good commentary. Also, for just a bit of trivia, they have a fun bit about a scene with Clint Eastwood as a pilot towards the end of the film that was cut, although you can still see his face in a jet pilot mask in one of the nearer ending shots of the movie, if you look for it. So that's two giant monster movies for him because he's also in them, if you didn't know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then Revenge of the Creature is his debut, so.
Oh, shit. So three. Well, look at that. Craziness. Yeah, so anyway, that's just a little bit of trivia. But yeah, Tarantula, definitely worth a pickup if you've been digging, as I have, the old sci-fi and horror stuff that that Scream Factory's been putting out lately.
Very cool. Yeah, I got to check that one out, too.
But that should do it for our little stacks here. Thank you, Rob, as always, sir.
Of course. Those were impressive stacks.
Yeah, we always bring the good stuff. So we hope you enjoyed it. And we will be back, in a month's time to go through another stack. I've already got mine started. So should be a blast. Everybody have a wonderful and Blu-ray-filled week. And we will talk to you very soon. Bye-bye.